This Sandwell News podcast is divided into chapters.
The Sandwell News, due with you on Saturday, June the 26th, if you're a postal listener, or a day or two earlier if you get the podcast or go online.
Sunrise this week will be at 4:45. Sunset is at 9:35. On Tuesday, it will reach 23 degrees, but it will be a bit windy.
Well, it's certainly chilly now, and it's nice to know that it will be a bit warmer again next week, but not back to the heat wave we had of a week or two ago, thank goodness. And the voice, it's difficult to know what happens with 11 Labs, where these voices come from, but somehow I lost track of Alice, so that was Amelia. And here's Amelia again with what's coming up with SVI this coming week.
Hello, SVI members, friends and volunteers. Here are the activities taking place next week. Monday, June 15th, breakfast brunch at the Interceptor, 10:30 to 12:30 p.m. Back due to popular demand, we are having another breakfast/brunch get together at the Interceptor, New Square, West Bromwich. Join us to enjoy a full English, a tasty snack, or even an early lunch. Please let us know that you are coming and we can reserve the table. You can just order and pay on the day. Tuesday, 16th June. Gym at Portway Lifestyle Centre, 10 to 12 noon. Break a sweat and boost your energy with fellow SVI members. From treadmills and bikes to weights, there's something for everyone and plenty of support to help you along the way. It's a fun, social way to stay fit and active all year round, rain or shine. Line dancing at Dartmouth Central Club, 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. Put on your dancing shoes and join Ray and Jean for a lively line dancing session full of fun and feel-good moves. Whether you're looking to stay active, improve your balance, or simply meet new people, this is the perfect chance. Absolute beginners are welcome. Just come along and enjoy. We'd love to see you on the dance floor. Showdown, Portway Lifestyle Centre, 2 to 4 p.m. Come and join us for this fast-moving interactive sport that's a mix of table tennis and air hockey. It's specially designed for blind and visually impaired players. But the best part is anyone can play and everyone has fun. Expect laughter, friendly competition, and a chance to try something a little different. Why not come along and see what it's all about? Wednesday, 17th June. Men's group at West Bromwich Town Hall, 10:30 a.m. to midday. Join the men for a social get-together. A chance to chat and set the world to rights. With tabletop accessible games, like dominoes, if you want to have a go. We want more men to join our men's group and welcome ideas of what we could do in the future and where we could go. Aquafit, Portway Lifestyle Centre, 1 to 2 p.m. Get summer body ready. This gentle toning activity in the water is suitable for everyone, with expert instructor Alison. Contact SVI if you are interested. Thursday, 18th June. Showdown, Portway Lifestyle Centre, 10 to 12. Noon. Come and join us for this fast-moving interactive sport that's a mix of table tennis and air hockey. It's specially designed for blind and visually impaired players. But the best part is anyone can play. And everyone has fun. Expect laughter, friendly competition, and a chance to try something a little different. Why not come along and see what it's all about? Dartmouth Park Walk, 12 noon. Summer is definitely here when the park walks come back. Meet us by the Dartmouth Park War Memorial, from where we will take a leisurely walk around the park and Sandwell Valley, stopping off for refreshments. Please let us know that you are coming, so we can make sure we have enough sighted guides. It is important that you contact the office either by phone, message, Facebook, or email to let us know that you are attending any of our events. That's all for this week. We look forward to seeing you soon. The SVI team, Sandwell Visually Impaired, West Bromwich Town Hall, Lodge Road, West Bromwich, B708AY, telephone 012 1525 4810. www.sandwellvisuallyimpaired.org.uk.
Some pieces from the week's readings from the Express and Star. Wednesday, 3rd of June news. The Albion season review. Back from brink of disaster. £1 million worth of fake goods found in raid. Controlling man jailed. Strike action starts amid fears about safety. Thursday. Wanted driver held after chase. Bomb suspect removed from court. E-scooter and car in collision. One dead, six injured in crash. Local character can hell high streets to survive. Friday. Arrest on find of laughing gas. Man dies as stolen car hits tree. Primary school cancels hot meals for remainder of year. Community hub closes food bank. Saturday, major plans to demolish and redevelop school. Council to decide on proposal for new homes. Two teenagers charged after double stabbing. Parcel firm cuts 60 jobs. Minestrone soup recipe. Monday, two more men face court charged with attempted murder. Johnson takes to seas to raise foundation funds. School boosted by solar panels. Heat could be World Cup players' toughest opponent. Tony's antidote to a mad world.
Those items coming up courtesy of Express and Star papers. I will say at the outset it's been a bit of a lean week for local news, and I'm sure Sue has been scratching her head wondering what stories to pick for us this week. But of course the World Cup is coming up, so the piece about heat being the thing that our players at the World Cup are going to have to overcome. As usual, we'll have TV and radio listings from Talking News Federation and one or two more articles from them, including a gardening article which I'm going to slot in after a piece about finding relaxation and peace in the garden. And I'm having a final visit to the Fixed Wheel Brewery. Right now, the first day's news from Mia.
Hi everyone, it's Mia reading some newspaper articles from the 3rd of June from the Express and Star. I hope everyone's having a lovely week and enjoying the somewhat nice weather that we did previously have. It is now becoming a little bit rainy, but I'm hoping that it starts to brighten up again soon as it is my birthday in a couple of days. And I'm also going to see Wicked in the theatre soon, so I'm very excited. Let's stay on track and let's read the article. The Albion season review. Back from brink of disaster. It was the season of countless lows and very few highs. For so long, Albion looked doomed to relegation to League One, in a slump that would have set Shailen Patel's ownership group, Bilkul, back significantly. But James Morrison, club servant of almost two decades, stepped in to steer the ship home at the 11th hour. Successes. These were few and far between. The season's major success was from March onwards, when Morrison was somehow able to steer the Baggies from the mire with a remarkable 10-match unbeaten run. He fully deserved to be appointed head coach on a two-year deal after achieving safety, something that essentially had to be completed twice following the controversial late two-point EFL sanction. The first month or so of the campaign also brought some hope. It proved to be false. Ryan Mason hit the ground running with three wins and a draw from four with his table-topping side. But things took a turn for the worse thereafter. His successor, Eric Ramsey, struggled badly from the get-go. Morrison brought in an inspired back-to-basics approach, and with players in more familiar positions and some new combinations, was able to inspire some consistent form from a squad lacking. It was clear Morrison was a popular candidate, and the players absolutely responded to his leadership. Failures. Chairman Patel said in a club statement in February, he takes full responsibility for the season's failings as the Baggies floundered around the bottom three. That was a few matches into Ramsey's doomed spell at the helm, and the former Minnesota head coach lasted another five winless games before his dismissal. It was further bad news when it comes to an on-field matters under Bilkul's Albion. Ramsey, following Mason and Tony Mowbray, was a third head coach, sacking in around 10 months at the Hawthorns, and it all pointed towards relegation to League One. Other failings came at boardroom level, with the broken relationship between Patel and forming sporting director and club president Andrew Nesta. There was explosive news in the new year when Nesta, a close confidant of Patel, departed the club after a disagreement over the direction of travel. Bilkall's Albion have rebuilt and moved on since. The next steps under Morrison brought success, but the jury remains out on the ownership's calls. Managers. The season started well under Mason, narrow victories putting Albion at the summit. The goals did not flow under the former Tottenham man, and it appeared his side was one built on solid foundations, ready to nick a winner. But things went the other way, as Mason's side looked for more in the final third. They unravelled spectacularly in the Baggies' defensive third, with an appalling lack of clean sheets ramping up pressure. Sections of the support had lost faith by the end of October, and results were not consistent enough to improve. Mason picked up the odd home win to stay in place. The board were particularly keen for him to succeed, but the beginning of January felt like a late dismissal. Ramsey's 44-day, 9-match winless spell brought zero encouragement. The Welshman, like Mason, aged 34, and inexperienced in the Championship, had to hit the ground running but did anything but. It was a gamble from the owners and the hopeless. Despairing stint plunged the Baggies further towards relegation. Ramsey's axing was humiliating for all involved. There was still time to rally, but things appeared bleak. More so after defeat in Morrison's opener, before he somehow pulled it together. Off the field. There was instability off the field at the Hawthorns. It was the first example of public disagreements and a change of direction under the ownership of Patel's Bilkall. The season started with sporting director Nesta, elected as the man to lead the football calls, promoted to a bizarre role of club president. No more than a handful of months later, Nesta departed the Hawthorns after disagreements on matters surrounding the end of the Mason and start of the Ramsey era. The recruitment drive led by Nesta with Ian Pearce in tow was at best mixed. Albion had to respond to the sales of Torbjörn Heggem and Tom Fellows, where hands were forced. Key men like Darnell Furlong left on the eve of the season too. In most cases, these were not suitably replaced. January signings, Danny Imre and Max O'Leary, did at least help towards survival. There was one big late off-field sting with the controversial EFL profit and sustainability sanction. It was a peculiar episode in which Albion were found guilty, regardless of their disagreement. PSR is soon to be a thing of the past, but it was a harsh lesson and could have proven very costly. So what next? Nothing more than significant improvement is acceptable. There can be hope and optimism for what is ahead this season, with how Morrison ended the season. But this is a different job for the club legend now, and he will require support. The late season form showed what the squad was capable of, but the group needs surgery for it to be a consistent outfit pushing for the top 8 places next season. Supporters remain grateful for how Bilkall rescued the club from the clutches of the doomed Goachan Lay nightmare. But after a near disastrous season and several failed appointments, there is a need for progress. 12 months ago, with top target Mason at the helm, was supposed to be a bright new era for the ownership. But there has to be hope it is the familiar hero, Morrison, who can lead that cause. Dominic Price, the newly appointed technical director, has had time to get his feet under the table and already has a strong relationship with Morrison and Pearce, as the trio plot the way forward. Albion are working from a low bar when looking to improve. A repeat cannot be allowed. £1 million of fake goods found in raid. A £1 million Aladdin's cave of fake designer goods have been discovered in a warehouse in the Black Country. Perfume, electronic goods, watches, scarves and trainers are among the goods found piled up in the Smethwick lockup. They were uncovered in a raid carried out by Sandwell Council's Trading Standards Officers in partnership with West Midlands Police and Brand Protection Officers. The goods were being advertised for sale online on TikTok. Brands offered up included Chanel, Louis Vuitton, Prada, Apple, Canada Goose, Moncler, Rolex, Burberry, Nike, and others. Evidence suggests the goods were imported from China and Hong Kong and stored in the lockup ready for delivery. Investigations are going to bring the perpetrators to justice, but the estimated value is around £1 million. The discovery is seen as a major victory for Trading Standards Officers. They warn counterfeit goods are not victimless, often linked to organised crime and exploitation, including child labour. The items for sale also pose significant safety risks. Councillor Bob Jones, Sandwell Council Cabinet Member for Environment and Enforcement, said, "The council is committed to working with partner organisations to protect consumers and tackle illegal trading. Consumers are urged to avoid buying counterfeit goods as they are often unsafe, poor quality, and not covered by consumer protections. Purchasing such items may also contribute to criminal activity. Previous testing has found counterfeit perfumes can contain harmful chemicals, while fake electronics may cause fire hazards, electrical faults, and potential hearing damage." Controlling man is jailed for causing victim humiliation. A 27-year-old Albury man subjected a woman to repeated punches and kicks, which left the victim feeling humiliated and degrading, a court heard. Wolverhampton Crown Court heard how Ben Creswell's controlling behaviour resulted in the woman being isolated from friends. He constantly checked her phone messages to see who she was communicating with and told her who she could see, subjecting her to interrogations resulting in rows and her suffering mental health issues. Recorder Joanne Barker said Creswell wanted the woman to be at his beck and call, and she was terrified of leaving. He initially denied offences of assault, coercive and controlling behaviour, assault, and possession of cannabis. Mr. Ekwal Taiwani, prosecuting, said incidents including on May the 7th, 2022, when the defendant of Priory Drive, Albury, assaulted her, causing bruises. He said, during a row in June 2023, Creswell punched her in the face, resulting in her falling to the floor and stamped on her legs. In her impact statement, the woman explained how she returned home one day to find her clothing ripped. She stated that years after the incident, she was still receiving therapy for what happened. Mitigating for Creswell, Mr. Jonathan Barker said his behaviour was deeply unattractive but that he was remorseful. Creswell was jailed for 2 years and 7 months, minus time already spent in custody. He must serve at least half before being released on licence. He was also made subject to a restraining order. Strike action starts amid teachers' fears over safety. Union says school staff feel concerns are not being taken seriously after protests held. Teachers, teaching assistants and support staff at the Orchard School in Albury began strike again, citing concerns over safety, staffing levels and the school's ability to cope with the growing pupil numbers. Staff represented by the GMB and NSUWT unions staged a protest outside Sandwell Council House in Albury, chanting "cuts to staff, that's not okay. Children's safety is at stake today." The action follows allegations that school leaders failed to adequately respond to concerns raised by staff about pupil and staff safety, including claims of health and safety issues at the Specialist Send School on Causeway Green Road. Sandwell Council said the safety and well-being of children remained its top priority and confirmed it was investigating the concerns raised by staff. Speaking at the demonstration, GMB regional organiser Rachel Fagan said workers felt their concerns were not being taken seriously. We're here because San Juan Council aren't listening. They aren't taking the concerns around what's happening at the school seriously. And the most important issue is safety, she said. That's safety of the children and the staff. And with the amount of children that have been brought into the school and are protected and are projected to be coming to the school. It's a sensory school and it needs more space and a bigger environment. And I don't think the classroom calculations are being done correctly. Miss Fagan said staff recognised the need for additional SEN provision, but argued that increasing pupil numbers without expanding facilities were creating problems for both children and employers. In its statement, San Juan Council said it was investigating the concerns raised by staff and maintained that the safety and well-being of children at the Orchard remained its foremost priority. The strike action is expected to continue while discussions remain ongoing. On this day, June the 3rd, 959 AD, Edgar, first king of all England, was crowned on Whit Sunday by Dunstan, Archbishop of Canterbury, in the Saxon Abbey on the site of the present Bath Abbey. 1899. Johann Strauss the Younger, Austrian composer, violinist and conductor, who wrote the Blue Danube Waltz, died. 1899. England cricket captain W.G. Grace played his final test match, aged 50, against Australia at Trent Bridge. 1931. The Bard Company televised the Epsom Derby, which was transmitted by the BBC. 1937. The Duke of Windsor, the abdicated King Edward VIII, married Mrs. Wallace Warfield Simpson in France. 1949. The first bikini bathing suit was unveiled in Paris, invented by Louis Reard, a former motor engineer. 1956. Third-class rail travel was abolished in Britain and renamed second-class. 1965. The Gemini 4 spaceship was launched with James McDivitt and Edward White on board. During the flight, White became the first American to walk in space. 1971. The longest-running comedy in theatre history, No Sex Please, We're British, opened in London, with Michael Crawford in the cast. It closed on September 5th, 1987. 1978. The Guinness Book of Records went into the Guinness Book of Records as the most stolen book from British libraries. On this day last year, Irish rap trio Kneecap announced their biggest headline show outside of Ireland at London's OVO Arena, Wembley.
This is Alison, reading a selection of articles from the Express and Star, Thursday the 4th of June. Wanted driver held after chase. A wanted driver was arrested following a lengthy foot pursuit through gardens and a building site in Tipton, West Midlands police have said. Officers from the force's road crime team spotted a car being driven by a man who was wanted in connection with several offences and was also disqualified from driving. When officers attempted to stop the vehicle, the suspect abandoned the car and fled on foot. A dramatic relay-style chase then unfolded, with officers pursuing the man through residential gardens and across a nearby building site. After an extensive search and pursuit, the suspect was eventually detained and arrested by officers. West Midlands Police said the man was wanted for a number of offences and remains in custody while inquiries continue. Bomb hoax suspect removed from court after undressing. Hearing involving teen charged over alleged hoax at Peter Kay Show is cut short. A 19-year-old charged over an alleged bomb hoax, which forced a Peter Kay comedy show to be evacuated, had to be removed from a Crown Court hearing after he started to undress. The hearing for Omar Majed, who appeared at Birmingham Crown Court via video link from HMP Brinsford, was cut short after prison officers removed the defendant from the room, when he started to take off his prison-issue grey tracksuit bottoms. Judge Andrew Smith KC was trying to address the defendant, who was not arraigned during the hearing due to the need for psychiatric reports, to let him know when he next needed to appear. Judge Smith cut short his remarks to Majed and stated for the court record that prison staff had understandably escorted the defendant out of the video hearing room. A further case management hearing for Majed of Saltley, Birmingham, who was charged with communicating false information to police contrary to the Criminal Law Act, was set for July the 27th, and a provisional date for a trial, lasting 2 weeks, was scheduled for November the 3rd. Kay, aged 52, was ushered off stage during his show at the Utilita Arena in Birmingham on May the 1st, and the show was cancelled after the evacuation. West Midlands police later said nothing suspicious was found during searches. In an update on May the 2nd, the force said an evacuation of the arena was ordered yesterday evening after a report of a suspicious bag being left in the area. Following searches, nothing suspicious was found, and we are grateful to everyone for their cooperation and understanding. As always, our priority is the safety of the public. The show was part of Kay's Better Late Than Never national tour. E-scooter and car in collision. Two people were left with potentially serious injuries after an e-scooter and car collided. A man and a woman were involved in a collision whilst riding on High Street, Smethwick, on Tuesday evening. West Midlands Ambulance Service were called at 11:21 p.m. and sent two ambulances, two paramedic officers and a Merritt trauma team. A spokesman said, when ambulance crews arrived on the scene, they found a man and a woman who had been injured after reportedly falling off an e-scooter following a collision with a car. Both patients sustained potentially serious injuries and received trauma care on scene before being conveyed to Queen Elizabeth Hospital, Birmingham for further treatment. The car driver was uninjured. One dead and six injured in crash. A man died and six other people were injured after a car crashed into a takeaway building in Tipton. Emergency services were called to High Street, Prince's End, at around 10:20 p.m. on Tuesday, following reports of a vehicle colliding with a building. West Midlands Ambulance Service dispatched a major response to the incident, including six ambulances. On arrival, crews found a Honda Civic that had suffered significant damage after striking the Cantonese takeaway. The driver, a 48-year-old man, was found in a critical condition. Despite receiving advanced life support treatment at the scene, he was pronounced dead a short time later. A female passenger sustained serious injuries and was taken to hospital for further care. Two boys who were in the vehicle suffered minor injuries and were taken to hospital. Two girls also travelling in the car sustained potentially serious injuries. Both were taken to hospital. A passing cyclist, believed to have been involved in the aftermath of the collision, suffered minor injuries. He was assessed by ambulance staff at the scene before being discharged into the care of relatives. A spokeswoman for West Midlands Ambulance Service said, crews arrived to find a car which had been involved in a collision with a building. The driver, a man, was in a critical condition. He received advanced life support on scene, but was sadly confirmed deceased a short time later. Police have appealed for witnesses to the collision. Local character can help High Streets thrive again. Cratering consumer confidence and the collapse of major UK retailers are causing concern about the future of the UK High Street, write Edward Thomas Jones and Lindo Osti, senior lecturers at Bangor University. High Streets have traditionally exemplified the historical, cultural, and economic vibrancy of British communities. But today, they're more likely characterised by modest footfall, derelict buildings, and boarded-up windows. Efforts to help High Streets to thrive again should involve making them more individual and uniquely based on local quirks. This quirkiness could be used to attract visitors interested in seeing something new. Rather than a repeat of the same shops and businesses on every high street up and down the country. But all too often, when the problem of the UK's dying high streets is discussed, the crisis and contraction in retail is often seen as the fundamental challenge to address. While the prosperity and vitality of UK high streets has come to rely heavily upon shoppers, making space for organisations with a social purpose could create more sustainable change. The death of the high street is usually blamed on the rise in internet shopping, but in reality, it reflects more serious weaknesses in the shopping-centred model that has guided the development of these streets since the 1940s. Over the last three decades, the growth of mass production and mass consumption has allowed global corporations to thrive on our high streets, selling products to a worldwide market and making distant places look and feel the same. Instead, the identity of high streets should be in the hands of the local communities. They could initiate new uses for empty spaces to create a more authentic high street experience. To do this, locals need to ask fundamental questions about their high street. What is it actually for? What makes it successful? And what sort of social and economic functions should it perform? Developing high streets for the local community means ensuring accessibility, regardless of income, age, ability, or social background. Local authorities can also be empowered to purchase sites at below market value to address the problem of overpriced and underused high street buildings. These spaces could be used by the community to provide social benefits, including residential housing, community-led initiatives, health-related activities like exercise classes, and to house small local businesses, not just commercial retail. This would shift the power over how to save high streets to a model where the community decides what's best. There have been a number of modest moves in this direction, including the opening up of vacant property to community groups, and the promotion of various forms of temporary, often low-value commercial activity in central areas. From a social perspective, community-led initiatives in high streets can also help to maintain, hand down, and evolve the identity of towns and cities. Social identity creates a sense of belonging and promotes pride and social cohesion among citizens. Tourists and investors may also be attracted when a strong social identity makes a town or city unique and interesting for visitors. This kind of authenticity is important, not only for the identity of the local community, but also for attracting visitors who might spend money. This shouldn't be the key focus, but of course it helps the local economy. Community authenticity is based on culture, customs, and traditions. This means ensuring products and experiences such as events, food and works of art are made by the locals, according to their customs and traditions. In an era of increasing change in our communities, as they constantly reinterpret themselves, what is considered contrived at one time could be considered authentic at another. Safeguarding the historical essence and genuine character of urban spaces like high streets plays a pivotal role in upholding their distinct identities.
Hello, it's Rachel here, and I've got some readings for you from the 5th of June. Arrest on find of laughing gas. A man was arrested after police recovered laughing gas following reports from the community about drug dealing in the Black Country. On Sunday evening, neighbourhood officers from West Midlands Police acted on information from residents and arrested a man who was sitting in a parked vehicle on Addison Terrace, Wensbury. Following searches, officers recovered 10 boxes of nitrous oxide, known as laughing gas, along with balloons in carrier bags. Police said a man was arrested under suspicion of possession with intent to supply Class C drugs. A spokesman for the force added the man, aged 24, had been bailed pending further inquiries. Man dies as stolen car strikes tree by Mimi Ibrahim. A man in his 40s has died after a collision with a tree involving a car that police believe was stolen earlier in the night. Investigators said that they understand the vehicle, a BMW, had been stolen from an address in Oldbury. The police said that inquiries were underway to establish the exact circumstances of the collision, with CCTV being retrieved and reviewed. Officers were called to Oldbury Road, Smethwick, at the junction with Spon Lane South, at just before 12:45 a.m. yesterday. The driver, in his 40s, was being treated by paramedics from West Midlands Ambulance Service after being cut from his vehicle by firefighters. He was pronounced dead a short time later. A West Midlands Ambulance Service spokesman has said, "Upon arrival, ambulance staff discovered a man who was the driver of a car which had been involved in a collision with a tree. He was extricated from the vehicle by the fire service. Once extricated, he was assessed and was in a critical condition. Ambulance staff quickly began administering advanced life support to him. Unfortunately, despite their best efforts, it became clear that nothing more could be done to save him, and he was confirmed deceased at the scene. West Midlands Police say the man's family have been informed and are being supported. Anyone with information, especially dash footage, should contact police via their Serious Collision Investigation Unit by email at sciu@westmidlandspolice.uk or call 101. Primary school cancels hot meals for the remainder of the school year. A primary school in Tipton recently informed parents that there will be no hot meals for the remainder of the school year. The head teacher at Glebefields Primary School in Tipton told parents in an email that the school has made the decision to end the contract with the school's dinner provider due to unsatisfactory meals provided. As a result of this decision, there will be no hot meals served at the primary school for the remainder of this academic school year. Hot meals are expected to make a return to the school in September 2026. In an email seen by the Express and Star, the school's head teacher informed parents that, "Unfortunately, we have had to make the decision to terminate the contract with our school dinner provider due to unsatisfactory meals being provided to the pupils on a daily basis." The email went on to say that packed lunches will be offered in the interim. The head teacher continued, "Due to this, we are unable to provide hot lunches this half term, but have managed to arrange for a packed lunch option." One concerned parent expressed concern about how this decision may impact disadvantaged children at the school. The concerned parent said, "Parents today have been notified children will not be provided with hot meals during the last term. While there is no legal requirement for schools to be provided with hot meals, it is concerning considering the fact the area is one of the most deprived in the West Midlands and the UK. Many children won't have food in the cupboards at home, nor will they have a hot meal." A spokesperson for Glebefields Primary School via Sandwell Council said, "We are offering packed lunches as a short-term measure until the end of the school year to ensure pupils can have a school lunch. We started with a new school meals provider after Easter, but we were not satisfied with the quality of lunches provided, and we also received complaints from families, so we have terminated that contract. We have apologised to pupils, parents and carers for any inconvenience. Although there is no statutory requirement that school lunches must be hot meals, we recognise the importance of offering hot lunches to children, and these will be available again from September with a new provider." Shock as Community Hub and Food Bank Closes Doors for Good by Dan Stacey. Residents have been left stunned after the sudden announcement that Brandhall Community Hub and Food Pantry in Oldbury has permanently closed its doors. In a statement released on Facebook this week, organisers said the decision has been made with great sadness and acknowledge the impact the closure would have on local people who relied on the service. The Food Pantry, which has supported families and individuals across the area, confirmed that operations have ceased immediately due to funding issues. "We realise this will be a great shock for many people and can only apologise for the sudden nature of the closure," the statement said. The announcement has prompted concern among regular users of the pantry. The hub has since provided users with details of a pantry in Smethwick and its opening hours. Community members have been quick to share their reactions on social media. Among them, James Lynch paid tribute to those involved in running the project. He wrote, "This is very sad to hear, but everything has a season. The commitment of the four churches who work together so beautifully is nothing short of inspirational." Mr. Lynch also thanked key volunteers and organisers, including Lorraine Webster, Matthew Knott, Kath Tranter, Jeff Rowley and Reverend Rachel Heathfield, as well as many others who had worked to make the project a success. The Brandhole Community Hub may be no more, but the stories, the memories and the inspiration for other projects live on, he said. An update from the Community Hub said, all pantry users should have received an email with the new pantry details. Jay's Food Pantry, Hurst Road, Community Centre, Smethwick, B67 6ND. Sessions are Tuesday 6 till 7 PM, Wednesday 10 till 1 PM. Along with the article is a photograph with the caption, Brandhall Community Hub, home to a food bank, has closed its doors, and shows Brandhall Community Hub with the doors open and balloons are displayed outside.
Hello everyone, this is Linda, reading from Saturday the 6th of June's Express and Star. Major plans to demolish and replace school to be decided by council. Major plans to demolish and replace the majority of an Oldbury school are to be decided next week. Six old buildings at Perryfields Academy in Old Acre Road, Oldbury, will be knocked down to make for a single three-storey replacement under the plans by the Department for Education. The application submitted at the end of last year said most of the buildings had come to the end of their serviceable life. Sandwell Council's Planning Committee meets on June the 10th to make a decision with the recommendation from the authority's planning officers that the work is given the green light. A report which includes the recommendation said, the proposed development would be acceptable because it accords with policy. Replacing an existing school on an existing school site does not cause any significant harm to private amenity and would not be detrimental to highway safety. The majority of the school's old and temporary buildings will be flattened, including the unused two-storey block, a modular building and the school's gym, dance studio, changing rooms, dining hall and kitchen. A two-storey teaching block would be the only building to remain on the current site, with the new three-storey building built on the school's existing playing fields. The new sports and playing fields, including space for grass football pitches and a running track, as well as a five-a-side pitches and basketball and netball courts, would then be built on the old school site and car park. A new car park would replace the school's former sports hall and outdoor sports courts. The school's Old Acre Road entrance would also be widened to allow for two-way access to ease congestion problems. The application said that demolishing the old building would reduce change over times between lessons and allow for a more open landscape to improve site surveillance and the safety of pupils. The work to the 1,200 pupil school in Old Acre Road, Oldbury, will be completed by 2029, according to the application. It is hoped the new three-storey building will be built by early 2028. The remaining work, including the new sports field, is expected to be completed by early 2029. Council is due to decide on proposal for new homes. The authority's planning officers have recommended the work is approved. Plans to build 100 flats and homes as part of huge regeneration plans for former factory sites around a Midlands hospital are to be decided. Sandwell Council plans to build 74 new flats and 26 homes on the abandoned former GKN factory in Cranford Street, Smethwick, next to the Midland Metropolitan University Hospital. The new housing is the latest part of huge multi-million pound regeneration plans around the Smethwick Hospital. Sandwell Council's Planning Committee meet on June the 10th to decide on the plans. The authority's planning officers have recommended the work is approved when councillors meet next week. The council's planners said, the application proposes an appropriate reuse of brownfield land, which would deliver a much-needed mix of new housing for the borough. The proposal seeks to deliver residential properties on land allocated for housing in the development plan. It will provide much-needed homes in Sandwell and contribute to the range of accommodation types available. In addition, 25% of the units will be designated as affordable housing secured by condition. Much of the site has already been cleared, with the three-storey buildings fronting Cranford Street also set to be demolished. The five-storey apartment blocks would mostly be built facing the canal and hospital, with two blocks and new three-storey houses fronting Cranford Street. A statement including the application by Sandwell Council said, "The proposal, though ambitious, provides a well-designed, simple residential environment." The borough was awarded £18 million by the government in levelling up funding in 2024, which, after a range of delays and talks, can now be spent by March 2028, 2 years after the original deadline. Sandwell Council will also be contributing £2 million towards the work. Two teenagers charged after double stabbing. Two teenagers, both aged 18, have been charged after a double stabbing during disorder in Smethwick. Police arrested the two teenagers on Tuesday evening as part of their inquiries into violent disorder in Foundry Lane on the 26th of May. Brendan Singor, aged 18, from Birmingham, has been charged with two counts of attempted murder, wounding, and possession of an offensive weapon. Jaden Smith, aged 18, from Birmingham, has been charged with possession of an offensive weapon. They were remanded to appear before Birmingham Magistrates Court on Thursday. In total, West Midlands Police have now charged three men and two teenagers following this order, which saw two men taken to hospital with stab wounds. Police said that their investigation remains ongoing and we ask anyone who has not yet spoken to us to come forward. The force added, "We have set up a dedicated web page where footage can be uploaded securely. https://orlo.uk/smn-stie. You can also get in touch by calling 101 or via live chat on our website, quoting log5971. Of the 26th of May. Information can also be passed to Crime Stoppers anonymously on 0800 555 111. Parcel delivery firm cuts 60 jobs. Yodel has slashed 60 lorry driver roles in its bid to become a locker first service, according to the GMB union. The delivery giant was said to have told workers it was with regret that approximately 60 LGVI roles would go across its site in Wensbury and also at a site in Hatfield, Hertfordshire. Nicola Savage said in a statement, "Cutting these jobs is both cruel and short-sighted. Our hard-working, dedicated members are devastated. Agency usage is at a high in Yodel, whilst loyal employed workers face the axe." Parcel delivery group Yodel was acquired by InPost last year in a £106 million deal. A statement from InPost said, "As InPost continues to grow, we regularly review our network to ensure we remain responsive to customer demand and aligned with our long-term strategy. As part of that review, we have entered a period of consultation regarding a number of LGVI driver roles across two of our sites. We are fully committed to supporting all potentially affected colleagues through this process, and we will do everything we can to retain roles wherever possible," the firm added. At the time of the acquisition last year, InPost said its purchase built on a partnership between the two companies that began in 2024. A recipe for minestrone soup. Minestrone is a great example of why Sardinia is one of only five blue zones in the world. It's a simple, accessible dish packed full of seasonal vegetables and legumes. Even today, minestrone is still something that we eat very often. My advice would be to use my recipe as a guide, but try to make it seasonal and make it your own, just like we do in Sardinia. Ingredients serves 4. 100 grams of dried bolotti, cranberry beans. 100 grams of dried chickpeas, garbanzo beans. 1 onion roughly diced. 2 celery sticks chopped into 1 centimetre cubes. 1 large carrot peeled and chopped into 1 centimetre cubes. 2 tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil plus extra for drizzling. 2 garlic cloves finely chopped. 3 sun-dried tomatoes finely chopped. 15 grams of basil. 15 grams of parsley finely chopped. 3 large tomatoes roughly chopped for halved if using small tomatoes. 1 large potato peeled and chopped into 2 centimetre cubes. 4 large Savoy cabbage leaves, tough stalks removed and roughly chopped. 40 grams of pecorino grated or 4 tablespoons of pangrattato, see below. Fine sea salt and freshly ground black pepper. Method. The night before, wash the beans and chickpeas in cold water. Place them in a large bowl and cover them with fresh cold water. They will expand as they soak, so make sure the container is large enough and there is plenty of water. Cover the bowl and leave them to soak for at least 12 hours or longer. Check the packet. The next day, drain and then rinse the beans and chickpeas thoroughly with fresh water. Set aside. Place a large casserole dish, Dutch oven or ceramic pan over a medium heat. Add the onion, celery, carrots and olive oil and cook for 8 to 10 minutes, stirring occasionally. Now add the garlic and sun-dried tomatoes and cook for a further 2 minutes. Tear the basil leaves and stir them in along with the chopped parsley and cook for another minute. Next, add the tomatoes and potato. Give everything a stir and cook for a further 2 minutes or until the tomatoes are starting to soften. Add the drained beans and chickpeas and a good pinch of salt and pepper. Cover with water and bring it to the boil. Once boiling, reduce the heat back to medium. Cover and cook for 1 to 1.5 hours. Or until the beans and chickpeas are soft. If needed, top up with water so that the vegetables are always submerged. Once the beans and chickpeas are cooked, add the cabbage, cover and cook for a final 10 minutes. Taste and adjust the seasoning before serving. To serve, use a slotted ladle to divide the vegetables, beans and chickpeas equally between serving bowls, then pour over the warm broth. Sprinkle with cheese or pangrattato and drizzle over some olive oil. If you want to save time or you are making this at the last minute, you can swap out the dried pulses for a 250-gram tin of bolotti beans and a 250-gram tin of chickpeas. If using tinned, add them along with the cabbage.
Hello, this is Janet reading from the Express and Star for Monday, the 8th of June. Two more men face court charged with attempted murder. Two more men have been charged in relation to a stabbing in Smethwick. Nizar Abdul Hafiz, aged 19, and Deandra Cunningham, 18, are both charged with 2 counts of attempted murder and possession of a bladed article in relation to a disorder on Foundry Lane last month. The pair, both from Birmingham, were due to appear at Magistrates Court on Saturday. West Midlands Police have confirmed that 5 men and 2 teenagers have been charged in connection with the incident on May the 26th, which saw 2 men attending hospital with stab wounds. However, investigations are ongoing. A spokesperson for the force said, "We are aware of video footage of the incident continuing to circulate, and we would urge people not to share this to avoid causing unnecessary distress or potentially prejudicing legal proceedings. A dedicated web page remains in place where footage can be uploaded securely to help our investigation. You can get in touch by calling 101 or via live chat, quoting log 5971 of 26th of May. Johnson takes to the seas in bid to raise foundation funds. Former star Andy Johnson insists it is a privilege to tackle huge challenges in support of the Albion Foundation as he prepares to kayak the English Channel with partner Kelly. The ex-Baggies midfielder is no stranger to testing himself in aid of the club's charity arm, and the duo will be part of a team of a half dozen foundation staff and volunteers bidding to cross 21 miles from Dungeness on the English coast to Boulogne in northern France on Monday, July the 27th. All proceeds raised will go towards the Albion Foundation as the couple look to raise £3,000 each. The idea began between Johnson and Deputy Foundation Director Jonathan Ward last year, and training has been strenuous throughout 2026, as popular club co-commenter Johnson admitted he started from a level of being unable to stay afloat. When we first started, I was falling in and they kept calling me Michael Phelps, Johnson smiled. The pair have the hang of it now and recently completed a training week featuring three different routes, kayaking more than 30 miles in total. He added, "We did 14 miles on the Sunday, 6 miles on Wednesday, and 14 miles on Sunday again. We've been smashing it. It's all right. You ache when you do it. In the first one, I could hardly move, but it gets easier every time you do a bit. Out on the water, the wildlife you see is unbelievable. We're hooked. We're upgrading the kayak and we're doing it." The couple have graduated to a two-person kayak and training has taken them between Ross-on-Wye to Simmons Yacht, Bridge North to Bewdley and between Twining in Tewkesbury and Pershaw. The mission proper comes late next month when the team hope for right conditions to brave the challenge for charity. They will be joined by a support and medical boat, which fundraising has generously covered. The route will briefly take the team onto the support boat as French authorities have denied passage through their shipping lane. Johnson, a two-time Albion promotion winner and close associate of the club, added, "I am relatively confident. We've done 14 miles and it's hard. It was hard going, but another 7 miles on top of that. I think the adrenaline and everything about the occasion will get you there. When you see land, the other side, it'll be the inspiration we need to finish it." To support the team with any donation, visit https://albionfoundation.enthuse.com/cf/the-albion-foundation-kayak-english-channel. School boosted by solar panels. Primary, one of first in country to benefit from £80 million initiative to reduce bills. A Black Country school is one of the first in the country to have solar panels installed as part of an £80 million government scheme. Eton Valley Primary in West Bromwich has had 200 panels installed, and MP Sarah Coombs climbed onto the roof to see the panels at first hand. She said they would not only cut bills, but also help pupils understand where energy will come from in the future. An initial 200 schools were expected to benefit from the scheme announced in March last year, with savings projected at £400 million over the next 30 years. Ms. Coombs said a number of secondary schools in West Bromwich had already benefited from the scheme and the programme was now being extended to primary schools. She said, not only will these installations help schools save money on their energy bills, but they will also give young people the opportunity to learn firsthand about renewable energy and the transition to a cleaner future. Eton Valley headmistress Claire Evans said that in just 1 week, the panels had saved more than £150 on the electricity bill, meaning the money could go to supporting pupils. Heat could be World Cup players' toughest opponent. The 2026 FIFA World Cup is the biggest ever edition of the world's most watched sporting tournament, writes Donald Mullen, senior lecturer in physical geography at Queen's University, Belfast. The 48 teams taking part in Canada, the US and Mexico may find their toughest opponent is the extreme heat. Very hot temperatures are expected across many of the states, including Texas, California and Florida, where World Cup games are being held this summer, with wildfire risks being highlighted in some states. The tournament kicks off on June the 11th. The problems heat causes during matches were visible during the 2025 FIFA Club World Cup, played in the same summer months and across many of the same North American venues. Players and managers repeatedly referenced the stifling weather conditions. Juventus manager Igor Tudor revealed that 10 players asked to be substituted during a match against Real Madrid in Miami, where temperatures reached 30 centigrade with 70% humidity. North America's last World Cup, USA 1994, also produced memorable scenes relating to heat. German striker Jürgen Klinsmann recalled, I played in Dallas at 120 degrees, 49 centigrade. I was dying in a match against South Korea. Extreme heat is not just uncomfortable, it threatens both health and performance. Football already has documented causes of heat-related fatigue, collapses and hospitalizations, including Guatemalan referee Humberto Pangos collapsing during a 2024 Copa America match in Kansas City. Heat also changes the game itself. Studies show players cover less distance, perform fewer high-intensity sprints and get tired more quickly in extreme conditions. Tired players are more prone to mistakes and injuries, while hotter matches have been linked to more penalty shootouts. Scientists commonly use wet bulb globe temperature, WGBT, to assess heat stress. Unlike air temperature alone, WGBT combines temperature, humidity, solar radiation and wind, making it a better indicator of how dangerous conditions feel to the human body. Several football governing bodies, including the Global Players Union, FIFPro, consider a WGBT above 28 degrees centigrade to be a threshold where matches should potentially be delayed or postponed. A study I led in 2025 found that 14 of the 16 upcoming World Cup host cities are likely to exceed the extreme 28 centigrade WGBT threshold if conditions this summer are typical. Most of the danger falls during mid-afternoon, and FIFA has clearly tried to reduce some of the risk through scheduling. Compared with the Club World Cup, matches in the hottest cities and non-air-conditioned stadiums have largely been shifted away from the most dangerous hours of the day. That will help, but it will not eliminate the problem. tens of thousands of spectators will still spend hours travelling, queuing and celebrating in dangerous outdoor heat. Many fans are older, less physically fit than elite athletes, dehydrated from alcohol consumption or arriving from cooler climates with little acclimatisation. Yet FIFA's current heat policy remains limited. All matches will have 3-minute hydration breaks midway through each half, but the thresholds for stronger action remains exceedingly high. Tony's antidote to a mad world. With the world slowly morphing into a dystopian nightmare of titanic proportions, I thought it was about time for some gentle and soothing tales of sanity and common sense. The good weather has seen our gardens suddenly transformed from a dull, weed-infested wasteland into a riot of colour and aromas. Where a single pale blue foxglove stood, there are now a dozen or more, and her many and different coloured hydrangea bushes are starting to blossom, even her new addition, a rare blue one, ditto my new blue moon rosebush. Add in her strawberry patch, which has produced the first pickable fruits of the year, and my single vine, which shows the beginnings of at least 10 bunches of sweet black grapes. From nowhere, a blackcurrant bush has sprouted. I can only think from seeds in bird droppings. Pulling out what I thought was a weed was a whole walnut planted by a squirrel that had grown roots and a 4-inch stem. I replaced it and hopefully it will flourish like my small hazelnut tree, again originally planted by a grey squirrel about 5 years ago. I even got round to making 2 new garden tabletops, replacing the ones which, after 30 years, had finally rotted out. With some new thick smooth timber, screws, glue and many layers of wood stain, finished off with a coat of yacht varnish, they were fitted to their stands and both now sit proudly waiting for their first visitors, one at each end of the south pasture. The garden lawn, which was renewed just 18 months ago, has finally matured into a lush, deep green carpet, helped along with regular injections of lawn feed and careful mowing. Throw in the refurbishment of the 2 sheds with new featherboard cladding, finished with a lick of paint and new locks and handles, and both look like new. Hopefully, when this new heat wave materialises in a week or so, sitting out under a parasol with a good book and a glass of something cold and fizzy will make it all worthwhile. So that's it, folks. Not much more to report. The common lizards are still housed under their rocks around the fish pond. Ditto the toads under their rock, who come out at night and scavenge in the garden. The big alpha fox still uses our garden at night as a through route from his den in the canal bank, just next to the family pile, to his hunting grounds, and the domestic ginger tomcat chances his arm as it wanders through the back gardens like Jack the Ripper on the hunt for unsuspecting nocturnal walkers. All the above is, I hope, an antidote to the sheer lunacy, craziness and mayhem that have enveloped Europe and the Middle East. Please accept it all as a measured and gentle response to a world gone mad. Note, it occurred to me that we Homo sapiens are the only species on this blue-green rock that kill for hate. Fur, feathers, fin and insects only kill for food and self-defence, but not us. Think about that. Tony Levy, Wensfield.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
This is Jan with some seasonal tips and ideas from the gardening expert at the MK Pulse magazine based in Milton Keynes. With things warming up and extra light afforded us during this time of year, our plants and flowers should be blooming. But they aren't the only things that benefit from the long warm days. Weeds make the most of it too, and seem to spring up just as soon as your back is turned. While a cleverly cultivated outdoor space is a beautiful thing, it is also worth remembering that weeds are simply plants in the wrong area. Take the cheery dandelion, for example. They are flowering fantastically just now and are a valuable early food source for bumblebees and solitary bees, hoverflies, day-flying moths and butterflies, who make the most of their nectar and pollen. If they aren't interfering with your best garden displays, would you consider letting the dandelions stay? Their bright yellow flowers are visible from March through to October, but this time of year is when they are at their most abundant. They are easily adaptable and can grow anywhere, from fields and roadsides through to your carefully maintained garden. And their seeds are plentiful. A flower can have as many as 400, although on average around 180 are released from each head. If left to its own devices, dandelion plants have been found to survive between 10 and 13 years, which is quite something, though not if you are a gardener being driven mad by this persistent player, which keeps on trucking despite best efforts to remove it. Before having a lovely lawn became a thing, dandelions were a favourite blossom, and grass was often moved out so that the dandelions could flourish. These masters of survival have long been revered for their first aid properties, and hundreds of years ago they were used to treat a variety of ailments, from warts to the plague. And it seems that our ancestors really were onto something. That little plant that you showed such disdain for happens to be rich in vitamins A and C, and also boasts a whole load of other goodness. In her book, Eating on the Wild Side, author Jo Robinson said that compared to spinach, dandelion leaves have 8 times more antioxidants and 2 times more calcium. They are also said to be a good source of iron, magnesium and potassium. Today, dandelion tea is readily available to purchase, and the leaves act as a diuretic and help aid digestion. And while the recipes have changed with time, just what do you suppose dandelion and burdock is all about? The drink has been taken in this country since the Middle Ages, and while it's a readily available carbonated treat today, in bygone times it was a type of mead. As a youngster, my rabbit would love it when I'd return home, having spied and collected some spectacularly sized dandelion leaves, which would be washed and presented before currants devoured them with glee. My bunny and our pollinators clearly know a good thing when they see one. Whether you love it or hate it, the resilient dandelion is certainly a fascinating plant with a long and rich history. And try as you might, this persistent garden dweller is going nowhere anytime soon. When you spray nasty pesticides or chop one down, you also cut down a food source for Bertie Bee, which is food for thought. So, how does your garden grow? Seed balls are great fun for children and adults, and whether it's in a plant pot or a patch in your garden, sowing wildflowers provides vital resources to support a wide range of insects that couldn't otherwise survive in urban or built-up areas. Seed balls are a mixture of wildflower seeds in a nutritious and protective coating. Examples of seeds you could use include yarrow, pheasant's eye, cornflower, cosmos, California poppy, borage, dill, linen flax, stocks, and candy tuft. So, how to make them? Mix together in a bowl 5 parts of clay soil, 1 part compost, and 1 part wildflower mix seeds or similar. Water it drip by drip. When it becomes moist enough to form into balls, press it together with your hands. Dry the balls on a tray to harden them off for a day or two before clearing a patch of soil of weeds and water well. Then scatter the balls evenly over the area. Water regularly. Alternatively, just throw them onto a patch of waste ground and hope for the best. Parents won't want to have to buy numerous packets of seeds to do this project, but you can buy single packets of wildflower seeds or butterfly attracting seeds. And the top tip this month is: greenhouses can overheat at this time of year and need adequate humidity and shade to ensure plants are happy and leaves aren't being damaged. If it's a gloriously hot day and a balmy night, feel free to leave the door to your greenhouse open throughout. When it comes to humidity, which is necessary to prevent heat damage during hot spells, damping down usually dry, hard areas like pathways in greenhouses is a brilliant and simple way to avoid problems.
TNF Soundings.
We must now be clear about how your information is used and the steps we take to ensure it is secure. When you asked to receive recordings produced by the Sandwell Talking News, you gave your name and address so that we could send you our memory sticks or CDs. This information is stored in a secure database, and address labels are also stored in a secure location. Having left our premises, the address labels and postal wallets are then under the protection and care of Royal Mail. Your contact details are only used for sending you our memory sticks or CDs, and will never be forwarded to a third party. If you ask us to stop sending the Sandwell Talking News to you, your contact details will be deleted from our database and your address labels will be permanently destroyed. We promise and assure you that we take data protection seriously and make every effort to meet the requirements of the Data Protection Act. If your circumstances do change, you move home, change your phone number, or wish to unsubscribe to the Sandwell Talking News, please call the office on 0121 525 4810 or email sandwelltn@gmail.com so that we can make the necessary changes.
Some audio described TV programmes for the next week along with radio programme highlights from Talking News Federation. Search for publications TNF Soundings to hear these directly on their website.
TNF Soundings.
Now for a selection of the audio described television programmes starting Saturday 13th of June and ending Friday 20th of June, compiled by Sarah, read by Diane, and with Richard doing the techie stuff. There's a lot of World Cup football this week, which is included here, even though it is not audio described. I do appreciate that not everyone will be interested in this. Let's start with Saturday. Unfortunately, there's slim pickings today. At 1:30 in the morning on BBC One, there's Match of the Day with live coverage of the opening match in Group D between host nation USA and Paraguay at the Los Angeles Stadium. If you're a fan of retro American comedy, there are endless episodes of Everybody Loves Raymond starting at 5 to 8 and ending at 11:20. This is followed by 3 episodes of The Simpsons. Over on BBC Two at 11:50, you can see the film The Importance of Being Earnest with Reese Witherspoon. On BBC Two at 12:30, there's James Martin's Islands to Highlands. This week, James takes a magical trip to the stunning Isle of Skye and is joined by Top Chef and Ultimate Scotsman Tony Singh. Over on BBC Two at 1:15, there's Homes Under the Hammer, short lease flats in London and Leicestershire. On ITV at 4:15, there's Capital's Summertime Ball, the UK's biggest summer party at Wembley Stadium, with A-list artists including Ray, Niall Horan, Calvin Harris, Fatboy Slim and more. Into evening viewing on Channel 4. At 8, there's Yorkshire by the Sea, this week in Burton Constable, or at 8:35 on BBC One, there's The Usual Dose of Casualty, with Dylan discovering the truth about Stevie and Maddie's relationship.
This is followed on BBC One at 9:25 by another episode of the drama series 2 weeks in August. At 10:30 on BBC One, there's more football, this time the opening match in Group C between Brazil and Morocco. Later on, there's a choice of films starting at 9 on Channel 4 with Where the Crawdads Sing. This popular book adaptation is about a feral child who is accused of murder in America's Deep South. This is followed at 11:20 p.m. by the Oscar-winning comedy drama Jojo Rabbit, about a young boy in crumbling Nazi Germany who has an imaginary friend called Adolf Hitler. Your third option is Taken 3 on ITV at 1:50. Now on to Sunday. There's early hours football on BBC One at 1:10 a.m. with coverage of the Group C match between Haiti and Scotland from Boston Stadium. At 11 on BBC One, there's Homes Under the Hammer, followed at 11:30 by Bargain Hunt. Your afternoon film is at 2:30 p.m. on ITV and is the classic Bond from Russia with Love, starring Sean Connery and Robert Shaw. Thankfully, there are more choices of programmes in the evening today. At 7:15 on BBC One, there's the second and final episode of the nature documentary Tiger Island, and at 9:15 on One, the penultimate episode of the drama Death Valley. Over on BBC Two, there are 3 hours of varied documentaries: Expedition Killer Whale at 6:15, Hidden Treasures of the National Trust at 7:15, and then Expedition with Steve Backshall at 8:15. On Channel 4, there's a new documentary, Free Nelson Mandela, which explores the extraordinary story of Nelson Mandela's journey from activist to revolutionary prisoner. In this first episode, Mandela is jailed for life in 1964 as activists and musicians rise against apartheid. If you fancy a film, the futuristic drama Children of Men, which explores a future where no more children are born, is on BBC Two at 10:45. Football closes play on BBC One with live coverage as Ivory Coast and Ecuador play their opening match in Group E at the Philadelphia Stadium. Before we move on to the rest of the week, here are the regular soaps and programmes which are on the same channel each day. Starting with the soaps, there are some changes this week due to the World Cup coverage. On Monday and Tuesday, it's EastEnders on BBC Two at 7:20, with Emmerdale at 8 and Corrie at 9 on ITV. On Wednesday and Thursday, it's just EastEnders on BBC One at 8:30. And on Friday, there's Emmerdale at 8, followed by Corrie at 8:30. In terms of regular programming on at the same time each day, BBC One have Homes Under the Hammer at 11:15, followed by Bargain Hunt at 12:15. Each afternoon, we have Escape to the Country at 3, with the exception of Friday when it starts at 2:45. On Monday, Tuesday and Friday, there's a new series, Travelling Auctioneers, at 4:30. And at 6:30 on BBC One each weekday is Great Continental Journeys, this time in Scandinavia. There's Tennis from Queens each afternoon, starting at 1 on BBC Two. This is not audio described, but may still be of interest to some. Also on BBC Two at 6:30 each weekday is Great Continental Journeys in Scandinavia. Similarly, ITV have live racing from Ascot from Tuesday to Friday at 1:30. Channel 4's regular programme, Car SOS, is at 12:10, Narrow Escapes is at 4, and Chateau DIY is at 5. Now on to Monday. In addition to the regular daytime and tea time programmes, this evening's football match is on BBC One at 7:30, with live coverage of the opening match in Group G between Belgium and Egypt at the Seattle Stadium. At 8 on Channel 4, Chris Packham investigates in Invasion of the Parakeets. Ring-necked parakeets are some of Britain's most divisive birds. Are they beautiful, charismatic newcomers, or are they an ecological menace to crops and native wildlife? This is followed at 9 o'clock by 24 Hours in A&E, when Sonny is rushed to Queens with multiple stab wounds and doctors are concerned about an 87-year-old woman who is coughing up blood. On BBC Two at 9, there's Brexit, A Very British Civil War, which is followed at 10 by another episode of Mortimer and Whitehouse Gone Fishing. This new series begins with Paul and Bob taking a trip to North Uist in the Outer Hebrides to catch fresh sea trout. After the news on BBC One, we are given some insight into how models suffer widespread exploitation and coercion at the hands of their managers in OnlyFans Inside the Machine. This is followed at 11:55 by the film A Simple Favour. A small-town vlogger tries to uncover the truth about her best friend's disappearance. Now for Tuesday. Football dominates BBC One today with two matches, France v Senegal at 7:30 and Iraq v Norway at 10:45. For a rest from football, there's Digging for Britain with Alice Roberts on BBC Two at 8, followed by a new series at 9, Scam Amanda. This four-part docuseries follows mother and blogger Amanda Riley, whose story of a cancer diagnosis elicits sympathy and support, but upon investigation, things don't seem to add up. On Channel 4 at 8, it's Bake Off, The Professionals, followed by a new series of the drama series The Light in the Hall, Still Waters, at 9. Decades after being jailed for the 1995 murder of his cousin, Rhys Owen returns to his hometown as a local journalist stumbles across a long-buried secret. You can round off your evening viewing with 24 Hours in A&E, also on Channel 4. Now on to Wednesday. Portugal play against the Democratic Republic of Congo on BBC One at 5:30. The series Changing Ends continues at 7:30 on ITV. This is followed at 8 by England's first game against Croatia, also on ITV. For something non-football related, head over to BBC Two at 8 for the repair shop. This week, the team restore a children's truck built by their dad, a cherished Dutch doll, and a moth-eaten fez from Egypt. At 9 on BBC One, Death in Paradise continues, and over on Channel 4, at the same time, you can catch the second episode of the series, The Light in the Hall. Round your evening off with Night Copper, also on Channel 4 at 10. Now for Thursday. Unsurprisingly, there was more football. The Czech Republic play South Africa, with coverage starting on BBC One at 4:30. And Switzerland take on Bosnia-Herzegovina over on ITV at 7. Channel 4 has a full evening of programmes for you. At 8 p.m, George Clark's Beautiful Builds continues, this week with Michelle in Windsor, who has got stuck updating her undesirable bungalow. This is followed at 9 by 24 Hours in Police Custody, when a missing man is believed to have been murdered. Finally, at 10 on Channel 4, there's a new series, The Accused Beyond Reasonable Doubt, which follows individual fighting convictions that they believe to be a miscarriage of justice. There are a couple more options at 9. BBC One have the last episode of Reported Missing, when the police launch high-risk searches for two missing women. On BBC Two, Queen James explores the life, loves and relationships of James I, the monarch whose deep affections for handsome young men shaped both his personal and political reign. And finally, on to Friday. At 7:30 on BBC One, the USA take on Australia in a Group D match. Over on Channel 4 at 8, there's another episode of Our Farm Next Door, Amanda, Clive and the kids. This is followed at 9 p.m. by Celebrity Gogglebox and then First Dates, both also on Channel 4. BBC Two have the final episode in this series of Hidden Treasures of the National Trust, this week focusing on garden designer Gertrude Jekyll at Munstead Wood, one of the Trust's newest properties. This is followed by Season 7 finale of Inside Number 9. There's one late film on BBC One at 11:55, an action thriller called Roadhouse. A once-famed MMA fighter, now down on his luck, is offered a job as a bouncer at a Florida bar, but his arrival does not suit the plans of a local gangster. For die-hard football fans, there are basically matches throughout the night, with coverage starting on ITV at 10. Scotland play against Morocco with a kick-off at 11 p.m. Brazil are against Haiti at 1:30 a.m. and it's Turkey versus Paraguay at 4 a.m. We do hope that you'll find something of interest this week.
Here are the radio listings for the 7 days beginning Saturday the 13th of June, compiled by Wendy and read by Jilly. Starting with Saturday 13th of June, an adaptation of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll is read by Alan Bennett on Radio 4 Extra at 12:30 and 6:30 p.m. Joseph Andrews Remixed is a dramatisation in two parts of Henry Fielding's novel about a good-natured footman and his eccentric friend. Part 1 is on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. Today's opera is Strauss's Der Rosenkavalier in a Royal Opera House production from 2004 on Radio 3 at 6 p.m. Moving on to Sunday the 14th of June. The Castaway in Desert Island Discs is actor Anna Maxwell Martin on Radio 4 at 10 a.m. While in Desert Island Discs Revisited, the castaway is champion racing jockey Frankie Dettori on Radio 4 Extra at 6 a.m, 11 a.m. and 5 p.m. An estimated 1 million people have had to leave their homes in Lebanon, which has been repeatedly hit by war. In Lebanon's Abandoned Lives, we hear about the realities of life in the country on Radio 4 at 1:30 p.m. The Little Otleys is a period comedy focusing on a web of romantic entanglements in Edwardian London on Radio 4 Extra at 1:50 and 7:50 p.m. Deja News is a quiz in which teams of contestants are questioned on a century of news archive. It's on Radio 4 at 4:30 p.m. Words and Music features poetry, prose and music evoking Restoration England, including readings from the diaries of Samuel Pepys and music by Purcell, on Radio 3 at 7:45 p.m. Current Affairs and From Our Own Correspondent is on Radio 4 at 9:30 p.m. Turning now to those programmes which are broadcast at the same time every day from Monday to Friday. 4 Days to Kill is a radio spy thriller by Robert Barr, following the exploits of Captain Jim Nicholson, played by Edward D'Souza, on Radio 4 Extra at 6 a.m, 11 a.m. and 5 p.m. Monday to Friday. The book of the week is Heatwave, The Summer of 1976, John L. Williams's non-fiction book charting the summer of heat, water shortages and cultural upheaval that rocked Britain, on Radio 4 at 11:45 a.m. each day this week. Under One Roof is a comedy drama about a mother, daughter and grandmother living together, based on stories by Michelle Hanson. It's on Radio 4 Extra at 8:45 a.m, 1:45 p.m. and 7:45 p.m. each day. In the Composer of the Week slot this week, Anonymous celebrates pieces whose authorships have been lost, deliberately obscured, or never recorded in the first place, on Radio 3 at 4 p.m. every day this week. The book at bedtime this week and next is Land by Maggie O'Farrell. Tomas and his son Liam are working to create an ordnance survey map of Ireland in the aftermath of the Great Hunger of 1845-52. It's read by Brendan Gleeson on Radio 4 at 10:45 p.m. Monday to Friday. Now, some individual programmes to listen to through the week, starting with Monday the 15th of June. Ella Fitzgerald, A Glorious Noise, is a 2017 programme examining the singer's work. It's on Radio 4 Extra at 10:30 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. In the series Nature Bang, the programme compares the bellowing roars of red deer stags to delve deeper into the psychology of the human voice, asking whether lower voices are taken more seriously. Radio 4 at 2:45 p.m. No doubt with the World Cup in mind, in 60 years of hurt, David Baddiel reflects on the collective and individual agonies of the penalty shootout on Radio 4 at 3:30 p.m. For fans of the panel show, there's an episode of Just a Minute on Radio 4 Extra at 2 p.m. and 8 p.m. And there's also I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue, hosted by Jack D on Radio 4 at 6:30 p.m. Now some suggestions for Tuesday, the 16th of June. The Medal Makers discovers the realities of being a judge at a sporting event with input from Olympic adjudicators on Radio 4 Extra at 10:30 a.m. Lucy Worsley begins a new series this week, Lady on Trial, exploring the lives of women involved in some of history's most famous and infamous legal battles. She begins with 19th century writer Caroline Norton, who campaigned to change the law on the custody of children, on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. In What's Up, Docs, Chris and Zan van Tulleken are at the Hay Festival to discuss what can be learnt from different countries and cultures around the world about how to live longer, healthier lives. It's Radio 4 at 4:30 p.m. And Radio 3 in Concert brings us a performance by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra of Mahler's Ninth Symphony on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. In Touch brings us news, views and information for people who are blind or partially sighted, presented as usual by Peter White on Radio 4 at 8:40 p.m. Moving on to Wednesday, 17th of June, in The Good Old Days, The Politics of Nostalgia, the programme delves into the archives to examine how politicians have used our love affair with the past and encouraged the nation that it's possible to reclaim it, on Radio 4 Extra at 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. The Missing Hancocks brings us a recreation of A Holiday in France, a lost episode from 1955. Modern actors play the roles of Harry Secombe, Bill Kerr and Sid James, but surprisingly, Tony Hancock didn't feature in the original episode. Radio 4 Extra at 7:30 a.m, 12:30 p.m. and 6:30 p.m. And Choral Evensong comes from the Chapel of Clare College, Cambridge, on Radio 3 at 3 p.m. Radio 3 in Concert brings us the first of two concerts from Snape Maltings as part of the Aldborough Festival, on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. The second concert is tomorrow at the same time. In a new era of multi-party politics, The Long View compares attitudes to electoral reform, past and present, on Radio 4 at 9 p.m. Round off the day with music in The Folk Show with Mark Radcliffe, on Radio 2 at 9 p.m. Then on Thursday the 18th of June, in a programme from 2006, in the series Great Lives, Dame Cleo Lane and Ivan Massow explore the career of Ella Fitzgerald, on Radio 4 Extra at 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. In Ramblings this week, Claire Balding meets Marlon Patrice for a walk up the Wrekin in Shropshire, on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. A new series of Feedback begins this week with a look into the mailbag of listeners' comments, on Radio 4 at 3:30 p.m. Amal Rajan and guests offer their insights into the biggest news stories of the week in Radical, on Radio 4 at 11 p.m. And so to Friday the 19th of June. The Wheels of Power hears from some of the drivers from the Government Car Service in the Thatcher era who drove ministers around in Rovers, Jags and Daimlers, on Radio 4 Extra at 10:30 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. The food programme this week asks the question, why isn't food part of cancer care? On Radio 4 at 11 a.m. Into the Wild, in the series Rare Earth, asks if there is any true wilderness left on our planet and considers the fear and fascination that the wilderness exerts. Radio 4 at 12:04 p.m. In Heart and Soul, Emily Wither speaks to Iranians inside the country about how war, repression and disillusionment have reshaped their relationship with religion. On the BBC World Service at 1:30 p.m. Enjoy your listening week.
TNS Soundings.
Hello, this is Janice reading from the Express and Star for Tuesday, the 9th of June. Arrest as axe is recovered. A 19-year-old man has been arrested after police recovered an axe during a patrol targeting serious youth violence and knife crime in West Bromwich. Officers, both in uniform and plain clothes, were carrying out a Project Guardian operation near West Bromwich Ringway at around 5:15 p.m. on Saturday, June the 6th, when they noticed a man behaving suspiciously close to a local gym. The man was detained by officers, who then conducted a search of the surrounding area. During the search, an axe was recovered. The 19-year-old was arrested on suspicion of possessing an offensive weapon. He was later questioned by police and has since been released on bail while inquiries continue. Protesters in demonstration outside hotel. Protesters were seen waving flags and playing music as they demonstrated near a Sandwell hotel to protest the use of hotels for migrants. The protesters were near the Ibis Hotel on Wolverhampton Road, Albury, flagged by officers with West Midlands Police. As of Saturday afternoon, the protest was described as peaceful by both sides, with members talking between themselves, filming live videos and making speeches. It comes as anti-migrant hotel demonstrations continue to be held outside of her hotels, suspected of being in use to house migrants, with similar protests taking place at the former Victoria Hotel near the Wolverhampton Grand Theatre and the Roman Hotel on Watling Street, Cannock. The protest seemingly had plans to remain peaceful through the day, with demonstrators saying they were simply expressing their rights. One protester, who didn't want to be named, said, "Everyone is okay today. We are all smiling and there is a good mood. We are just expressing our rights in a peaceful way. We are having a peaceful protest." West Midlands Police confirmed the protest had been peaceful. Baggies to face the owls behind closed doors. Albion have confirmed they will play a behind closed doors pre-season friendly against Sheffield Wednesday. The two sides will meet at St George's Park on Saturday, July the 11th, as part of their preparations for the new EFL season, in a repeat of the final day fixture from last term. Wednesday won that match 2-1, their only home win of a nightmare campaign, which saw them finish bottom of the championship table on 0 points after being docked 18 points for severe financial mismanagement. Albion, themselves docked 2 points by the league for breaching profit and sustainability rules, had secured their survival in the second tier the previous weekend. The defeat was the only one they suffered after James Morrison was confirmed as manager until the end of the season in early March. Morrison, now appointed permanent boss, having masterminded the escape from the drop, is now preparing for his first pre-season in management. Albion's players are due to return to training later this month, and the match with Wednesday will be one of several warm-up fixtures. The only other match to be confirmed at this point is a trip to League One Peterborough on Saturday the 1st of August at 3 p.m, a week before the new season begins with the first round of the Caribou Cup. Ex-footballer pitches in for match in aid of military charities. An ex-professional footballer is holding a charity football match in Albury for Armed Forces Weekend. Michael Husbands, who played as professional at clubs including Aston Villa, Southend United, Port Vale, Walsall, and went on to serve in the Royal Marines for 5 years, has organised a charity football event at Worley Rugby Club in Albury to raise awareness and funds for Scotty's Little Soldiers and the Royal Marines Association charity. Mr. Husband said, "The charities we've chosen are both military charities that do brilliant work supporting serving personnel, veterans and their families. A number of the guys involved in the event have close personal links to people who have been supported by these charities, so it's something that means a lot to the teams involved. The event will be taking place on June the 27th with Royal Yeomanry, Dudley-based armed reservists, taking on Royal Marine veterans. Entry is free, with the bar opening at 9:30 a.m. and kick-off at 3 p.m. There will be street food, karaoke, a charity raffle and a disco. The event is being held on the day of an England World Cup game when the Three Lions are taking on Panama, so there will be big screens." Mr. Husbands added, "It's set up to be a really good day out with free admission. You've got a competitive and entertaining football match between military teams, plenty going on around it for families, and the chance to support two fantastic causes. We are also going to organise a small kids tournament before the main game. On top of that, the England team will be playing on a TV in the World Cup. The people involved, alongside Mr. Husbands, are Anthony O'Malley, Sonny Mumford, Samantha O'Malley, Melanie Jones, Jamie Mumford and Tarjinder Singh Bassi."
Welcome back to the Express and Star Pub Quiz. News. Question 1. Musician Ronald Lapreed has died in New Zealand aged 75. But which band was he a co-founding member of? Question 2. Which former England footballer is to receive a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame? Question 3. Which I'll Be Back film star was given an honorary doctorate by Ulster University, the top honorary degree the university can bestow? Sport. Question 4. Which is Great Britain's most northerly national hunt racecourse? Question 5. Who won women's 800-metre gold ahead of Stephanie Graf and Kelly Holmes at the 2000 Sydney Olympics? Remember when? Question 6. The first provincial ITV station started broadcasting in the Midlands. Newcastle United beat Portsmouth 2-0 in the first floodlit league match. And the Queen opened Britain's first full-scale nuclear power station. But what was the year? Question 7. Jamaica achieved independence after 307 years of British rule. Fidel Castro was excommunicated by the Pope. The world's first passenger hovercraft service travelling between Rhyl and Moreton Beach opened. and Sonny Liston knocked out Floyd Patterson to become world heavyweight champion. But what was the year? Who am I? Question 8. I am an American-born British actress born in 1949. I have worked extensively with the Royal Shakespeare Company, and I was the first person to speak on the stage of the newly completed Shakespeare Globe in recognition of my father's 23-year campaign for its reconstruction. I have won 2 Laurence Olivier Awards and was appointed an OBE in 2001 for services to drama. My roles include Madam Hooch in the first Harry Potter film and Susan Harper in the BBC sitcom My Family. But who am I? Question 9. I was a campaigner born in Warwickshire in 1910. My concern about the decline of moral standards in Great Britain during the 1960s led me to create the Clean Up TV campaign in 1964. Prime Ministers Wilson and Heath found my campaigns frustrating, and although Thatcher was sympathetic, my numerous letters to Downing Street were reportedly ignored or lost. In the 1980s and 1990s, my name was used in the title of a topical comedy show on television and radio. But who am I? Local knowledge. Question 10. Cynthia Erivo once interrupted her performance of Dracula after spotting an audience member filming the show. Andrew Scott halted his To Be or Not to Be during Hamlet when an audience member took out a laptop to send emails. And recently, Gone Girl actress, whose father once taught at the Birmingham Conservatoire, received a round of applause during the final bows when she called out an audience member for texting, stating, "Texting in the climax of this devastatingly emotional play broke the bond with the audience." But who was this actress? How's your knowledge for this week's quiz? Click to the answers to find out. Here are the answers for this week's quiz. News. Question 1. Musician Ronald Lapreed has died in New Zealand aged 75. But which band was he a co-founding member of? The Commodores. Question 2. Which former England footballer is to receive a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame? Sir David Beckham. Question 3. Which I'll Be Back film star was given an honorary doctorate by Ulster University, the top honorary degree the university can bestow? Arnold Schwarzenegger. Sport. Question 4. Which is Great Britain's most northerly national hunt racecourse? Perth Racecourse in Scotland. Question 5. Who won women's 800-metre gold ahead of Stephanie Graf and Kelly Holmes at the 2000 Sydney Olympics? Maria Matola of Mozambique. Remember when? Question 6. The first provincial ITV station started broadcasting in the Midlands. Newcastle United beat Portsmouth 2-0 in the first floodlit league match. And the Queen opened Britain's first full-scale nuclear power station. But what was the year? 1956. Question 7. Jamaica achieved independence after 307 years of British rule. Fidel Castro was excommunicated by the Pope. The world's first passenger hovercraft service travelling between Rhyl and Moreton Beach opened. And Sonny Liston knocked out Floyd Patterson to become world heavyweight champion. But what was the year? 1962. Who am I? Question 8. I am an American-born British actress born in 1949. I have worked extensively with the Royal Shakespeare Company, and I was the first person to speak on the stage of the newly completed Shakespeare Globe in recognition of my father's 23-year campaign for its reconstruction. I have won 2 Laurence Olivier Awards and was appointed an OBE in 2001 for services to drama. My roles include Madame Hooch in the first Harry Potter film and Susan Harper in the BBC sitcom My Family. But who am I? Zoe Wanamaker. Question 9. I was a campaigner born in Warwickshire in 1910. My concern about the decline of moral standards in Great Britain during the 1960s led me to create the Clean Up TV campaign in 1964. Prime Ministers Wilson and Heath found my campaigns frustrating, and although Thatcher was sympathetic, my numerous letters to Downing Street were reportedly ignored or lost. In the 1980s and 1990s, my name was used in the title of a topical comedy show on television and radio. But who am I? Mary Whitehouse. Local knowledge. Question 10. Cynthia Erivo once interrupted her performance of Dracula after spotting an audience member filming the show. Andrew Scott halted his To Be or Not To Be during Hamlet when an audience member took out a laptop to send emails. And recently, Gone Girl actress, whose father once taught at the Birmingham Conservatoire, received a round of applause during the final bows when she called out an audience member for texting, stating, "Texting in the climax of this devastatingly emotional play broke the bond with the audience." But who was this actress? Rosamund Pike. Thanks for joining me in this week's quiz. I'm Sarah Ann, and I'll be back next time. Bye!
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, my name is Lindsay. I started producing topical items during lockdown to keep my neighbours entertained. All the recordings are made inside my cosy cabin for that extra sense of calm. And naturally enough, I called them Cabin Conversations. I hope you enjoy them. Cabin Conversations about World Chocolate Day. This annual celebration possibly has the oldest roots, dating from July 1528, when conquistador and explorer Hernan Cortes brought the first viable cocoa beans back by ship to Spain from the Aztec Emperor Montezuma II of Mexico, Southern America. Yet the observance of World Chocolate Day on the 7th of July globally was only chosen in 2009 due to social media pressure. A bit like the Dubai pistachio-filled chocolate bars, which started a worldwide viral media trend 2 years ago. Millions of people suddenly wanted it. Although other chocolate recognition days do exist, internationally and locally, with many countries choosing different calendar dates. Despite Cortes being credited with introducing chocolate to Spain, and endorsing its health benefits as the divine drink which builds up resistance and fights fatigue, the people had to still improve the bitter, watered-down bean juice by adding cane sugar and mellow spices such as nutmeg or vanilla essence to create a more palatable drinking experience. The Italian explorer Christopher Columbus actually brought the very first cocoa beans to Europe earlier in 1492 on discovering the Americas, though failed to promote any real interest in the drink. Indeed, Spain quickly found its citizens addicted to chocolate, something reflected in the growing consumption statistics today. The top 5 countries are America, fast approaching 390,000 tonnes of chocolate annually. Second, Germany. Third, France. Fourth, UK, with Cadbury's brand showing the top 73% of sales in 2025. And lastly, Italy in fifth place. So who did invent the first chocolate bar? It was the UK company J.S. Fry and Sons, previously pharmacy owners, who purchased a reputable chocolate company based in Bristol and made the very first chocolate bar in 1847. Rowntrees of York won the prize medal at the Yorkshire Fine Art and Industrial Exhibition in 1866 for their rock cocoa, and this became a staple product at their works. Cadbury's of Birmingham were awarded the Royal Warrant from Queen Victoria. Indeed, during the Boer War in 1866, the Royals sent out a bar of chocolate to every soldier. Though Cadbury's made their true mark in 1868, with chocolate assortments popularised in fancy boxes. However, 7 years later, the Swiss company owned by Henri Nestlé managed to perfect milk chocolate, adding the once baby formula sweet condensed milk to the processed Dutch bitter cocoa powder. In fact, Nestlé produced a world premiere white chocolate too in 1936 and still available today. They bought out Rowntree's in 1988 and now own such classics as Smarties, Aero and Kit Kat. Incidentally, the latter was named after a famous mutton pie in the historic Kit Kat Club, London. 1962 was a time of highs and lows for chocolate in the UK. Rowntree's introduced their classic dark chocolate coated wafer thin after 8 mints. The name derived from the clock set to 1 minute past 8 p.m. on the box and aimed at adult indulgence after dinner. Meanwhile, the British government decided to make money from the consumers in a different way, bringing in a 15% purchase tax on chocolate and confectionery, being previously exempt as classified simply as food. There is debate over the most expensive modern-day luxury chocolate. The closest may be La Madeleine aux Truffes, a 70% dark chocolate containing rare French Perigord truffle, made by a Danish artisan chocolatier, Fritz Kernischild, from $250 or £185 per chocolate truffle. What is known, the rarer the chocolate, the higher the price, no matter the quality. For example, a 100-year-old bar of Cadbury's chocolate was auctioned in London for £470 back in 2001 because it was remarkably well preserved and had travelled with Captain Robert Scott on his first expedition to the Antarctic. Surprisingly, the ancient American Aztecs had used cocoa beans as currency and even faked beans out of clay to fool unwitting traders. Speaking of fraud, apparently due to the world crisis both environmentally and economically, chocolate has become a tempting commodity for criminals. One supermarket told the BBC that chocolate theft cost it £250,000 in 1 year. Of course, chocolate is not just for eating or drinking. It has many other unusual applications as well. Luxurious spa treatments paint on chocolate to enhance hydration and nourishment of the skin while lifting the client's mood. In the film industry, they have used chocolate syrup to make fake blood. And the University of Warwick successfully fuelled a Formula 3 racing car on a mixture of waste chocolate and vegetable oil. In addition to these initiatives, chocolate has inspired many a location, from hotels like the Chocolate Box Hotel Bournemouth, with themed rooms, workshops and tasting sessions, or chocolate tours, such as York's Chocolate Story Truffle Rolling Tour and the Chocolatarium Tour Experience, Edinburgh, making edible souvenirs. Visitor attractions include the Chocolate Museum in London, with virtual online access and outreach chocolate workshops, and Cadbury World, with its £8 million Cadbury Quest Adventure ride. May chocolate, whether drinking, eating, baking, or exploring, be a sustainable sweet treat for you in the best way.
TNF Soundings.
Now for the final part of our visit to the Fix Wheel Brewery in Blackheath, which happened around the time of the spring bank holiday.
Do you need a background in chemistry? Birmingham University used to do a degree in brewing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what sort of background do you come from?
So, me, for example, I had no background when I started brewing. In fact, all I had were some quite terrible GCSE results. And I was 15 when I first started my apprenticeship. My apprenticeship was 2 years at Nottingham University, where they've got a very, very, very nice £2.5 million pilot brewery for ABK. And there is a professor there, his name is Roderick White, who was the head brewer at Carling for all of them recalls. So how good he was, not sure, but he's brilliant. And yeah, so that's just an apprenticeship that you can do. There is a few online courses. So the... God, what the hell is the website called now? The IBD? IBCD? One of them. They offer online courses that are about 3 months. So you've got your foundation in brewing course, which is your 3 month basics, sort of all in one. Then you can do a diploma and you can pick which side of brewing you want to be on. So you can pick a fermentation diploma, a brew house diploma, or a packaging diploma. And then from that, you just go to your master's, which is where I hopefully can be one day. Yeah. I did the 2 year diploma at Nottingham for mine. And then I'm also currently doing the 3 month CIBD one, or IBD one. It's CIBD, yeah, it's definitely CIBD. So I'm also doing that one in a minute, because you need the foundation with the CIBD to do the diploma with the CIBD, and those courses are really flexible.
I suppose you're not so traditional that you deliver by horse and cart.
No, not quite.
Might be tempting with the way fuel prices are.
Yeah, in terms of time though, I bet it costs just as much for Yorkshire Brewery. Yeah, no, well, diesel van, that's it. That's what ours is.
You might have said before, when were you established?
We are 12 years old currently, so 2014 is when Fix Wheel Brewery first opened. There's a real thing going on at the moment in sort of British brewing. It's kind of really stripping away traditional brewers' opportunities to be traditional, which is just the fact that all of these much bigger breweries just combining all their brew houses. So instead of having... So Michelin Butler's obviously owns loads of different beers. I couldn't list them off for you, but I know they do. And they also own loads of different pub chains and stuff. What they will do is they'll just end up brewing all of their beers in one brew house or two brew houses on the same site. I mean, it increases consistency, which loads of people say is the difference. I think we're currently losing two pubs every day. We're losing, I think, like three breweries a week. No, three breweries a week would be impossible. It'd be something silly like that. It's more than you'd ever want it to be for a nice sort of heritage craft like brewing is. Yeah.
It's brewing a career choice.
What happened to M&B and Davenport's?
Sorry?
Davenport's and M&B.
Yeah, so they'll still be being brewed. I don't know about Davenport's. M&B's still brewing beers.
Where?
Could not tell you. I know that their headquarters is in Birmingham. I do not know where they're brewing currently. But yeah, loads of places like Banks's in Wolverhampton. That had been there 140 years. And they were brewing Banks's. They'd started brewing Hobgoblin. They might have been brewing Thornbridge beers as well. But I think I'm wrong about that. And they've shut down. They just shut down last year. And they 400 people employed in that brewery. Right in the centre of Wolverhampton. And like I say, just all these big... sort of big chain companies that are owning these breweries are just deciding it's not economically viable for you to have loads of little breweries. They'd much rather you have one big brewery where you can do anywhere from like sort of 60 to 80 brews a day. Yeah, they just want to increase the scale.
Davenport was a victim of, I think it was Green or Whitley who took them over in the mid-80s.
Yeah.
But they used to be brewed few hundred yards down the road from where I live, corner of Bath Row and Granville Street, and you could smell. No, I'm talking about Davenport's now.
Oh, sorry, I was thinking of
Ansell's used to be in Aston, I believe, but you could smell the beer brewing until the mid 80s when friends who live around there. But it was should have been a day of mourning when we lost Davenport's.
Yeah. I mean, as we can tell how important it is now, because all of you have just sort of pointed out really distinct memories of the smell of brewing beer. You know, it's an important thing that there are a lot of charities and a lot of sort of groups that are really trying to keep a nice grasp on traditional English brewing. You know, for example, we're the only country in the world now that brews into proper firkin casks, you know, pretty much. We're one of the only countries in the world that has coopers, and I think there's only 12 certified coopers in the country. Everyone else is either an apprentice or uncertified, and so that's just the way that the trades go in, unfortunately. Yeah.
Did beer brewing choose you as a trade, or did you somehow get into it by accident? Or
I was 15 when I started working, and when I was 10 or 11 I visited the Guinness Brewery in Dublin, St. James's Gate, and just sort of fell in love with it and then just didn't let go because I'm a stubborn bastard. Yeah.
So you found your vocation quite early on?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, it just made every other decision after that simple. Yeah. I didn't need good GCSEs. We had a couple of bars that we unfortunately had to shut down. Just because of, you know, we went through COVID and stuff and everything like that, and you just guaranteed to lose money and stuff then. Sort of it's hard to say how much profit, because whenever I've seen the numbers, you know, obviously it's not my job, they don't include any of labour costs, so they don't include how expensive I am per beer, so it's hard to say, but typically no, it's not a very profitable thing at all. Essentially, so that's the other thing that's sort of stripping away the traditionality, is you're kind of forced now to focus a lot more on volume than you are on the actual craft, and sort of you end up trading one thing in the other, in for the other. And yeah. Well, we've never had a desire to move the brewery from here, because, like I say, you started it here, and it's just sort of nice here. We're nice and hidden away, we're in a nice area, and we've been here a long time, and we're now a part of what I think is the most fun pub crawl that I've ever done, of about 18 pubs in 3 hours, which is very, very deadly. So, yeah.
You've got a few local outlets, haven't you?
Yes. So, typically, any Wetherspoons now, from here to essentially Lichfield, has our beer. Black Country Ales pubs all stocks our beer, but of course then you're lucky dipping on when they've got it on and stuff. And then loads of free houses, as much as we can support them, we do try to, because they're the actual foundation of sort of like British drinking is a free house. Lovely. Thank you all very much for your attention. I should probably move on to one of the other groups now.
Thank you for such a long session.
Age Without Limits Day 2026 is Wednesday the 10th of June. this year's theme, Question Ageism. Let's celebrate older people's contribution to our society, communities and families. Let's raise our expectations about later life. Here is a poem on ageism by Graham. Free at last to try something new. It'll be a blast, not confined to the few. It's the third age I'm on about. Unheeded, there'll be rage. Perhaps there's need to shout. Put to bed, age.
I didn't realise June the 10th was Age Without Limits Day, and it's actually the day I'm recording this round of thanks to everyone who's contributed to this week's Talking News. But that poem, of course, was from Graham Price, one of the founders of Samwell Visually Impaired, whose future is somewhat in jeopardy at the moment. But there'll probably be more about that next week or the week after. But least I forget, a round of thanks to our readers who this week were Mia, Alison, who also stood in for Pam, organising all the readers and getting those contributions to me, Rachel, Linda and Janet, not just once but twice, because it is the bank holiday or getting towards the bank holiday and quite a few people are away on holiday. Thanks to Sue, as always, for picking the articles. Quite a difficult week this time round. And to Tony and Gavin doing the copying. And I was with one of our new listeners the other day who does seem to be appreciative of what we do, and that's gladdening to me, because sometimes it's rather hard work putting it all together. I hope to finish off our excerpts from Heather Wastey's talk and performance that she gave to us at the AGM just over a month ago, so that may well be coming up next week. And if possible, I might try to find one bit of the two-hour meeting or more we had last Monday about how to make our voice heard about what could be the pending closure of Samwell Visually Impaired. In the meantime, I have to go now to make way for In Touch, which this week has an interview with, I think he's the chief ophthalmologist spokesperson for ophthalmology in the UK, and some thoughts on the future of Braille as well. That's coming up for now. It's bye-bye for now, and hope you enjoy the bank holiday. And it's going to get a bit warmer afterwards as we move into next week. Bye for now, and we'll be back with you again next week.
To use our talk phone service to listen to Sandwell Talking News or leave us a message, phone 0121 699 6696. If you are using a landline in the 0121 area, then just dial 699 6696.